From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. HBO's Sex and the City begins its fifth season on Sunday and has just been nominated for 10 Emmys, including Outstanding Comedy Series. On today's Fresh Air, we feature interviews with star Sarah Jessica Parker and writer and executive producer Michael Patrick King. Also, film critic Henry Sheehan reviews K-19, the new movie based on the true story of a nuclear accident on a Soviet submarine in 1961. It stars Harrison Ford and Liam Neeson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Wall Street has ended another week of triple-digit losses. Blue-chip stocks fell nearly 400 points today, losing another 4.8%. That's on top of huge losses the market has run up over the past 2 weeks. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
On Wall Street, the sell orders were flying fast and furious again as the curtain came down on another dismal trading session. For the week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost another 653 points. That's on top of a nearly 700-point loss for blue chips the previous week. Michael Farr is a money manager with Farr Miller in Washington.
Investor sentiment is very negative, and the first thought is to sell.
For the year, the Dow is now down over 19%. The NASDAQ is down more than 30%. And Farr says there's no firm sign of a market bottom yet.
Will it go lower? Probably. Trends last longer than anybody ever thinks that they're going to.
As to the reasons for the continued decline, everything from a lack of investor confidence in company financials to a record trade deficit is being cited. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The sheriff of Orange County, California, says a suspect has been arrested in the kidnapping and murder of 5-year-old Samantha Runyon. Sheriff Michael Cardona said the arrest of 27-year-old Alejandro Avila does not conclude the investigation. Avila was taken into custody after police obtained a search warrant for his apartment in a complex not far from where the girl's body was found. Authorities said Avila was tried and acquitted 2 years ago on charges that he had molested two girls under the age of 14. Samantha was abducted on Monday night and her body was found the following day. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip say Palestinian Authority police shot and killed the driver for a senior member of the Islamic Jihad faction today. The attempt to arrest the man, a Muslim preacher, was seen as a sign of growing tension between Yasser Arafat and other Palestinian factions. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Witnesses said the chase took place in the Mahrazi refugee camp in the central Gaza Strip. After the Friday prayer service, Imam Ahmed Hijazi, who has been highly critical of the Palestinian Authority, sped off in a waiting car as Palestinian policemen called out for him to halt. Palestinians on the scene said the police opened fire at the car and the driver was shot and killed. Hijazi fled the scene and apparently escaped. In many parts of the Gaza Strip, the Palestinian Authority comes in for harsh criticism, second only to the complaints leveled at Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and the Israeli army. Attempts to arrest or confine Hamas leaders have led to violent confrontations, which usually result in the police backing off. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 390 points or 4.6% to close at 8,019 in very heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 37 points. That's 2.8%. It closed at 1319. This is NPR News. DNA tests have confirmed that a body found in Pakistan last month was that of murdered American reporter Daniel Pearl. Wire Service reports, quote, U.S. and Pakistani officials are saying that the body is definitely that of the Wall Street Journal reporter who was kidnapped in January. The body was found in a garden on the outskirts of Karachi. The Department of Agriculture says the recall of beef products from a Colorado company has been expanded to include 21 states. Mark Roberts reports.
The recall is for hamburger produced by the ConAgra Beef Company based in Greeley, Colorado. Last month, the company warned consumers about beef contaminated with the E. coli bacteria. ConAgra recalled more than 354,000 pounds of packaged beef, much of it sold in Safeway stores. The E. coli bacteria comes from the intestines and feces of cattle. Victims stricken by the bacteria fall ill quickly. So far, 19 people in Colorado, Wyoming, and South Dakota have gotten sick from eating E. coli-contaminated hamburger. to kill the pathogen, consumers are advised to thoroughly cook all hamburger products. The voluntary recall amounts to 18 million pounds of fresh and frozen ground beef. For NPR News, I'm Mark Roberts in Denver.
Authorities in Greece have filed murder charges against the alleged leader of the November 17 terrorist group. The indictment charges 58-year-old Alexandros Giotopoulos with taking part in 13 murders, including those of two American military officers. The killings date back to 1984. Murder charges were filed against the second man, who's accused of killing eight Greek citizens. The November 17 group has been active in Greece since 1975. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Wellington Management, providing investment advice to clients worldwide, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new season of HBO's Sex and the City begins Sunday night. Later, we'll hear from its longtime writer and executive producer, Michael Patrick King. First, we hear from the show's star, Sarah Jessica Parker. Yesterday, the series received 10 Emmy nominations, including one for Sarah Jessica Parker's performance as Carrie Bradshaw. She's already won 2 Emmys for her performance on the show. This season will be shortened to 8 episodes because Sarah Jessica Parker is pregnant, but her character is not. Last season dealt with Charlotte's inability to get pregnant, Miranda's unplanned pregnancy, Samantha's falling in love, and Carrie's marriage proposal. While rummaging through her boyfriend's things, Carrie found the engagement ring that he planned to give her. Her response? She threw up. Here she is at the coffee shop talking with her girlfriends.
What did the ring look like?
Well, that's the other thing. The ring was not good.
What do you mean?
It was a pear-shaped diamond with a gold band.
Oh,
ick!
No wonder you threw up.
It's just not me.
You wear gold jewelry?
Yeah, like ghetto gold for fun, but this is my engagement ring.
I helped pick the ring.
You knew about this?
Aiden wanted a female perspective, and P.S. I was a pregnant woman shopping for a ring with a man who wasn't the baby's father. It's not exactly my dream scenario.
At least you're pregnant.
Are you gonna yell at me every time I mention it? Because we've got another 7 months to go.
I'll just say, I'm not ready to get engaged yet, but I love you, and I want to live with you. How does that sound?
Like a no.
Carrie accepted the marriage proposal with great ambivalence, but by the end of the season, the relationship broke up and all 4 of the leading characters were single again. In the final episode, Miranda gave birth to a son. I spoke with Sarah Jessica Parker last summer at the Old Wailing Church in Martha's Vineyard at a benefit for public radio station WBUR.
Well, let me start with something that I think people really do want to know. Could you ever imagine living the kind of social life that Carrie Bradshaw does?
No. No, I would be exhausted, and I'm far too old. I am a New Yorker at this point in my life. I've lived in New York City for about 25 years, so I know of these people. I know they exist. I've read about them in the style section. I've seen them on Lower Broadway hailing cabs at unseemly hours of the night in tiny skirts. And my single life was not nearly as colorful as that, which is perhaps why, as a married person, I enjoy playing this part so much. You see, I have to, and it's sort of like legalized illegal behavior. But I think at this point in the show, 4 years into the run of the show, it's become, I think, more specific. I think it's about 4 very specific women in a very specific city at a very specific time, and there's a sort of heightened reality to it, which may not really be consistent with single women anywhere, but I think it is the emotional journey that people seem to have responded to.
2 of the lead writers on the show are gay men, and some people have speculated that some of what happens on the show, particularly what happens to Samantha, who's the person who's really deep into sex, has more to do with like the gay male experience than the experience most women have. And I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
Well, I guess I disagree with that, because we have more female writers than male, and we always have. And I think that there obviously people's sensibilities on this show are primarily driven by the emotional search. And if the show were only that sensibility of an idea, a cliched idea about homosexual lifestyles, then they wouldn't be able to write Carrie with soul. And I think the beauty of a writer like Michael Patrick King and Darren Star, who's no longer with us, is that there obviously is a point of view and a perspective that they have because of their chosen lifestyle, but that is not what drives the show. And I think it's fun to sort of project onto Samantha in a general way that she's sort of this a gay man. But I think there are things about her that aren't specifically about gender or lifestyle, but that the other three women on the show are absolute archetypes, and they are intentionally so. We have Charlotte, who is hopeful and romantic, and Miranda, and these are bad, you know, two-word choices, but who is perhaps cynical and not trusting of love and what it might bring. And then there's Samantha, who is so comfortable with her sexuality, but they have to remain those for Carrie to write, for Carrie to be able to have this column. And the other thing is, I'm not even sure those people exist. I wonder if it's Carrie's imagination, that she has this vivid imagination.
That's interesting.
And that I don't even know that those women exist because they're so beautifully archetypal, and because she's given them depth as the seasons progress, that she might just be a good writer.
Because when people watch Sex and the City, they feel like they know you, or they want to get to know you, and they want to, you know, they want to know you above and beyond the character. But I think they'd probably make a lot of false assumptions about you if they were assuming that your character was like you. Being in such a high visibility role and being such a strong character on that, do people nowadays project things onto you which are just really untrue of who you are, and does that ever cause really awkward moments?
I think people say very intimate things to me without provocation. And some of it was, you know, very funny, and it would be good anecdotes for, you know, Letterman or something. But after a while, I felt that I had deceived. It made me uncomfortable because I felt like I wasn't really deserving of it, and it wasn't my place to know it because there wasn't a lot I could do with the information except thank them. You know, but what I've now, I think, is that I had an interesting thing happen. I went to see a play, and I walked into this man's dressing room, and who I don't know well, and he said to me, "Oh, I didn't recognize you with your clothes on." And this is like a real theater act. This is like a, you know, big time actor. And I thought, it's a thing that I struggle with the show for those people who haven't seen it, that they assume that it's four women running around New York City searching for the ultimate orgasm. And it's not about that. And I struggle very hard to convince people that without forcing them to watch the show, which I'm not, you know, disinclined to do. I would be happy to do that too, but that I don't run around naked on the show. I've never been naked on the show. You should recognize me with clothes on because I'm, first of all, not Carrie, and second of all, she wears clothing. Less so than more, you know, sometimes it's just a tea bag, but you could call it an outfit.
Well, speaking of clothing, she wears, like, incredible clothes. I mean, she has incredible outfits, and how do you dress compared to how she dresses?
I just wear more. I'm far less daring, far less daring. And really, I don't think my husband would be comfortable if I dressed like that, and I sort of honor his more...
You mean in a very provocative way?
Yes, provocative or, you know, yes. A lot of diaphanous things and...
A lot of navels.
Smaller, yes, exactly. And I sort of honor that about Matthew because it's one of the qualities I like about him, and... she's just a much more daring person and a much more eccentric dresser than I'll ever be.
Now, you've been acting virtually all your life. You were on Broadway when you were 10. Did you want to start acting, or did your mother nudge you into that?
Actually, my brother Toby was the first person in our house that was an actor, and I think what happened was, there was a supplement in our local paper in the Cincinnati Enquirer. It's called the Mini Page. It was for children. They had a little ad for an audition for the Little Match Girl. And we were taking creative dramatics classes, but everybody in the neighborhood did. You know, it's something you did on Saturday mornings at the University of Cincinnati. They had this program for kids, and I was also a dancer at the time. I was dancing with the Cincinnati Ballet Company as a student. And I just saw it, and I showed it to my mother, and I don't know what made me think that I even had a reason to go and stand in line on audition, but I just said, can we go? And she said yes, and she took me, and I auditioned, and I got the part of the little match girl. And at the time, what I loved about it was they paid me $500 cash, and they gave me $5 after shooting every day. They would drop me off in time to get to my ballet lessons with $5. And this was 1973. And at the time, an ice cream cone at Baskin-Robbins was a quarter. And two hamburgers, french fries, and a Coke at McDonald's, which I wasn't allowed to have any of these things if my parents knew about it, was less than a dollar. So I had basically about $4 left every day. And I thought, you know, coming from no money, I thought, well, this is it. This is the life, you know?
You're not supposed to eat McDonald's on the way to the ballet lesson.
Of course not. Of course not. But I was fast. I could eat when I was a dancer. I would eat so fast, I would take a bag of M&Ms and just open my gullet and just pour it in, because you had to get it in you before my mom caught me.
What was the problem with it? What was the problem, that it wasn't healthy or that it was too expensive?
It was both a combination of not good for you and too expensive. And also, my mother always knew which company was building bombs for the war, or, you know, which company had shut down a nursing home in order to put up a burger chef, or Hostess was involved with AT&T, and they were involved in the war in Vietnam, or the lettuce we couldn't have because of Cesar Chavez, and they only used iceberg lettuce at McDonald's. I mean, there was a heap of things that, I'm surprised we didn't starve to death with all the rules. And all the other kids in the neighborhood be going to, you know, whatever the local burger, you know, king chef. I don't want to indict anybody. But we weren't allowed. We had to have homemade hamburgers, and who wants those?
Your family was also on and off welfare for a while.
Mm-hmm.
What was the problem that caused the lack of income?
I think just simply not being able to make enough money. My stepfather was a truck driver. My real father was a writer at the time, and they just simply couldn't make ends meet. And my mother was not working at the time. She stopped. She was a school teacher, and she stopped when I was about 2 years old. And they simply couldn't make enough money to do everything that was required. You know, there were many times that we didn't have Christmas, or our phones were turned off. But the thing I want to say about that is that I didn't really know the degree to which it was different than anybody else in our neighborhood. I knew we were a little different when we didn't have Christmas presents. But I know that this is not an uncommon story. And I think the reason I didn't realize how different it was, especially because I grew up in an affluent neighborhood, was my parents were very smart about scholarships and free programs, especially in the arts. We could go to the theater and the ballet and the symphony for free. As long as we maintained a B average, we could take ballet lessons for free. It was a sort of contradictory life compared to what our financial means were. But they were smart, and we listened to NPR, so we were educated.
How did you end up in a wealthy neighborhood if you didn't have money?
Because there was one house on the block, we always found it, where a crazy man lived. And it was in disarray and in terrible neglect. And I think it was some tiny, tiny amount of money to buy. And so my stepfather's mother gave them the down payment, and they bought it for nothing. And it was on a beautiful street, and it was just a wreck of a house, and we somehow managed to make it more of a wreck of a house. So that's just another example of my parents' sort of industrious nature, you know?
We're listening to an interview recorded last summer with Sarah Jessica Parker. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview we recorded last summer with Sarah Jessica Parker at the Old Wailing Church in Martha's Vineyard.
You know, we were talking about Sex and the City. You basically went through puberty on stage. I mean, age 10, you were in a Harold Pinter play. Age 13, I think it was, you started Annie for 2 years on Broadway. Did you replace Andrea McArdle?
I came in when Andrea was an orphan. I mean, when she was Annie, I came in as an orphan.
Oh.
And then I matriculated to the role of Annie. After her replacement left the show, I was the third Annie.
So, you know, if you're doing Annie ages 13 to 15, you're pretty much kind of developing on stage and going through those sometimes really embarrassing changes or at least puzzling changes on stage in front of people, plus you're doing it playing a child.
Yeah.
What was that like? Did it make it more difficult to go through those changes?
I matured late. So those changes were more radical when I was doing Square Pegs, which were more appropriate to that show. However, there was a conversation about 2 months after I took over the role of Annie. The stage manager took me aside and he said to me, naturally, the year I took over the role of Annie, I grew 6 inches in a year, naturally. So he said to me, they were putting out a road company, and this little tiny thing came backstage. She was going to play Annie on the road, and she was easily a foot and a half shorter than I was. And he said, see that little girl? And I said, yes. And he said, you're getting too big. Put that on the back burner, he said. But just put it on your back burner, he said to me. And I thought, well, what are we going to do about this? I mean, what can I do? And I knew that he was suggesting that there was going to come a point that if I sat on Daddy Warbucks' lap, that it would look... Daddy's Warbucks agenda, it would switch. It would no longer be about his charitable nature, his like mercy, you know, his like desire to be a parent. And I was very, very worried. And then I told somebody, and they said, "Well, you know, there's you know simply nothing you can do." And I did exactly that. I thought, well, you know, I don't want to be short. I really wanted to be taller, and then I wanted to go to high school, and I wanted my brown hair back. Oops. I thought, well, you know, he's kind of right to have told me. It's like this harsh life lesson. And for a second, I was like, I'm just like Judy Garland with the pills and Louis B. Mayer. And this will be chapter 14 of my book, you know.
Well, it must have been very difficult to make the transition from, you know, like child star to woman and to, you know, adult actress. I guess it was lucky you had a transition in a way through Square Pegs, which is a TV series, a very good one, about high school and about a couple of misfits in high school, so that even if you were feeling a little misfittish yourself,
yes,
that would have been perfect.
It
to
was
be in
exactly
character.
And I thought a lot about that because my mother used to talk about this transition from child performer to adult actor, and that there was a really big difference and expectations were different, and that she thought what I should do is only work in the theater during that period where the way you are scrutinized was so much less, although not, I'm not talking about the New York theater critics, but the amount of numbers of people that you're exposed to, that you should just, she always said to me, just make smart choices now. Try to do good plays in New York where you just work on being an actor. And then Square Pegs came along, and she was very reluctant to let me work in television, very nervous about it. But she felt, my parents felt like it was a show about real girls and real feelings and what it's like to be, in fact, what I felt at the time, which was a misfit. I had been away from students for a long time. The minute I left Annie, I dyed my hair back to brown, and I went right to public high school, and I tried to fit in, and in fact, I really didn't. I mean, I had a couple of good friends, but it felt very right. It was a fortuitous moment, a short-lived moment, but just the sort of right amount of time to get through, in fact, what easily could have been a rough period if I wanted to pursue it as an actor.
You mentioned that you're concerned about what happens, you know, in a few years, because for actresses, it's much more difficult than for actors in terms of getting roles. What are specifically some of your concerns?
That I will be, you know, relegated to roles that aren't, you know, really fleshed out and interesting, that I will be... I just don't want to be sad about choices. I don't want to feel disappointed about the quality of opportunities. And so I try to be very realistic about what the future holds. I mean, I look at really wonderful actresses, some of the greatest actresses in my time, who struggle, who I've spoken to, who put their hands on their head and say, who would have thought that I would feel this way? Who would have thought that some young actress would be standing clutching a statuette saying, and you, I can't believe you're in the same category as me. You know, and the person's like, oh, I can't either. You know, that's the truth. And men seem to be more beloved and more revered, and the lines are more interesting and sexier, and it's simply not the case with women. And the parts for women get younger and younger and younger, and it's not a judgment thing, it's just a keen observation, or even not that keen. And so you just try to be realistic, and you try to remember that that's why the theater, not to use it as a salvation, but that's one of the beauties, is that, you know, Blythe Danner can come work in the theater in New York and do wonderful parts all the time, and Maria Tucci and Marion Seldes and a whole class of wonderful actresses, and Meryl Streep, because there are great roles in the theater for women, and they simply aren't completely always there in film, and more so in television, though they are.
One last question. Did you already know how to walk in really high heels for Sex and the City, or is that something you had to learn for the part?
Well, I do love high heels. I love them. And I thought I walked in them pretty well, but looking back now, I realize that I have achieved a skill, a level of not only walking, but running in high heels. I could run a marathon, and I love the way it makes me feel, and I love that my character gets to wear those great shoes.
Thank you so
much.
Oh,
my God, this is a joy. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Sarah Jessica Parker recorded last summer at the Old Wailing Church on Martha's Vineyard at a benefit for public radio station WBUR. Our thanks to our colleagues at WBUR who produced and recorded the event. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, shaping the characters and plots of Sex and the City, we talk with executive producer and writer Michael Patrick King. And Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie K-19, starring Harrison Ford and Liam Neeson. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. HBO's Sex and the City begins its fifth season on Sunday. The series was nominated for 10 Emmys yesterday, including Outstanding Comedy Series. Michael Patrick King was nominated for Outstanding Directing for a Comedy Series. King is the executive producer of the series and has written for it since the start of the series. He also wrote for Murphy Brown and was a consulting producer for Will and Grace. The four women at the center of Sex and the City have gotten older since the series premiered. Here's a scene from last season, after Carrie became engaged to her boyfriend. She realized she wasn't ready for marriage after trying on a wedding dress and breaking out in hives. Here she is with her three girlfriends.
My body is literally rejecting the idea of marriage. Just look.
Yeah, once you get a rash from a guy, it's time to heave home.
No, it's not him, it's me. I'm missing the bride gene. I should be put in a test tube and studied.
It's not just you. I don't want to get married.
Ever? Oh. Why do we even have to get married? Why? Give me one good reason. Aside from the not wanting to die alone thing. Which is something to think about, I admit.
Well, for me, when it was good, it gave me a sense of security.
But I feel secure now. Things are great with us. And you know what they say, if it ain't broke...
Don't marry it.
What are you afraid would change?
I don't know. Nothing? Everything?
Every bride feels that way at one point.
Well, why aren't they speaking up?
Carrie, I'm going to ask you an unpleasant question now. Why did you ever say yes?
I spoke to Sex and the City's executive producer and writer Michael Patrick King last winter when, as you'll hear, I had a bad cold. He told me why the writers decided to have Carrie get involved in a long-term relationship in the first place.
If we brought a new guy in, we'd have to go over the same, you know, defense mechanisms that any character would have. Whenever you fall in love with somebody for the first time or you start dating, you get to delay the reality of who you are for about 6 months, I think. And then the real stuff starts to come out. And we thought, well, rather than bring another new guy in for Carrie, let's bring Aiden back so we can really go beneath the surface of where we've already gone and try to figure out what happens to her when someone really starts to get close.
I'm going to stop you right there. That's very perceptive. You just said, that when you fall in love with someone new, you can delay the reality of who you really are for a
Well, you know, there's that philosophy that the real person doesn't show up until 6 months in. Up until that, for 5 months, you're just projecting who you think they are on them.
Oh, and the other thing is you can do what Richard Price calls the wonder of me for those first few weeks, a few months, where you tell all the great stories about yourself as if for the first time.
Yeah, and the best of you.
Exactly.
From your best CD of how you talk about yourself on a date. The other thing that's also very effective is on the first couple of dates, you perform your one-man show, which is you're so interesting at them, which makes a delay. You really don't know who. All you know is you're falling in love with you when you're talking to somebody else because they're telling you how interesting you are. So we thought, okay, we've done all the initial bull that you do when you meet somebody, and now we're bringing a guy into Carrie's house and into her life, and she has all sorts of baggage with him. And now it's like if it was a creme brulee, we can go right through the coating and into the goo and see what's there. So the first thing we wanted to do in this season was bring Carrie right up against her intimacy and her actual dreams of who she is as a person and what she wants out of life. So we moved Aiden as close as we could physically and as emotionally to her. And also we made pretty sure that Aiden was pretty close to perfect, which then we gave him a couple of flaws. But we thought it would be really great if she was the flawed one. As with all the girls on the show, what we try to do when we're writing is show that they're the problem.
And, you know, now that you've lived with these characters for how many years? 4 years?
Well, 4 years. 4 years.
And now that they're in their mid-30s and not their early 30s, do you feel like they have to be single in a different kind of way than they were when they were younger?
Yeah, the thing is what we try to do, and, you know, this, of course, added with the writer's imagination, but what we try to do is imagine, you know, what a good story would be, but based on what might really happen to these women in real life, if they weren't on television, what sort of bold steps would they make? And that's why we married Charlotte to Trey, because she would be married. That character, looking the way she looks, with her set of her checklist of what she wants out of life, would just get married. And so we thought, well, what would happen in life if Miranda did get pregnant and she was 36? What would she really do? She'd probably think, oh, this is maybe my last chance. Miranda has a weird ovary and. And so we just try to follow the impulse through. And with Samantha, what we thought might be nice is if she risked the ultimate for her, which would be love, rather than just, you know, crazy, unbridled sex, which everybody loves her for. And the thing that's so amazing about the episode where she actually falls in love on the rooftop is that people really responded to that. And the thing that I think is so amazing is it took us 4.5 years to give her that moment.
Right.
Whereas sometimes on network television, they say in the third episode, she has to be in love. We have to know that she has the ability to love. We don't like her. She's too surface. But for her to fall deeply in love with somebody, we thought, oh, okay, and it's time. And people seem to be ready for it. We were.
Now, Sarah Jessica Parker starts these new episodes engaged, but by the end of the third episode, she's realized she's not ready for marriage.
That was so difficult for us.
Yeah, and when she tells Aiden that she's not ready to marry, then he thinks the whole relationship needs to be ended. He's not going to stick around if she's not ready to commit.
Right.
And that's like a real surprise for the viewers. I'm just wondering what kind of conversations happen behind the scenes between the writers in making what for the character is a really big decision like that.
Well, there's two. The Carrie thing was really huge. Trying to figure out in the room with all the women writers and myself was trying to figure out, do women want to be married? Would they just go there? What is wrong with saying you're not sure if you want to be married? And that was the really heated discussion. And whenever we hit like a hot button in the room like that, I always try to chase it down because one of the writers, Julie, who's in the room, has been living with a guy for a long time and has no idea about getting married. She gets red. And I'm sort of like, what? You don't have to be with someone in order to be fulfilled. And then other women in the room were like, no, she should marry him. So it was a real excitement to try to figure out why she wouldn't marry him. And we had, when we came upon the thing of giving Aiden the push, when he starts pushing her, and I went up to our prop master, Travis, who is a guy married, and I said, what if she took the ring off her finger? What would Aiden say? Because Carrie wears the ring on a necklace. That was our first symptom that something was wrong. She was trying to distance herself from traditional marriage by making it jewelry rather than a commitment. And he said, no, I would want that ring on that finger because I'd want to lock this down. I'd want the world to know she's mine. And when I heard that, I thought, okay, that's very male, and a woman wouldn't want to hear that. Maybe.
What are some of the conversations that you've had behind the scenes about how to talk about sex on Sex and the City? Because the four main women characters talk about sex all the time, particularly when they meet at the luncheonette.
Right. We talk about the sex because we, you know, my feeling is that one of the reasons that people are excited about seeing the show is that we say stuff about a week before people say it. That's it. We're just like a week ahead. If we were 4 years ahead, people would say, they're crazy, and turn off the television. You know, the first thing is we decide we're going to talk about this topic because it's in the air. We feel it's in the air, and it's a little bit edgy, and primarily and foremost, and it's relatable, and then we can make it be funny. And the four girls, if you notice, it never talk about sex the same way, ever. When we want to send up a firework or really shock someone, Samantha opens her mouth. When we wanted to show a really strong opinion about it, it's usually Miranda. When we want to show the audience's reaction to it, the more conservative reaction to Charlotte will pipe in. And then when we want to show the people that are sort of trying to figure out what they feel about what we're saying, it's usually Carrie. Carrie is the listener, the sorter, outer. So when we say, how do you write about talking about, how do these women talk about sex? Well, they talk about it completely differently. There's like a very X-rated high school debate at the coffee shop. I mean, it's like the pros and cons of this or that or that.
Now, in an episode that you wrote, you know, right after Carrie's boyfriend moves in with her, she's worried that she can no longer perform her SSB, her secret single behavior. And these are all the things that you do when you live alone that you'd be really embarrassed to do in front of your lover.
Right.
I like to make a stack of saltines. I put grape jelly on them. I eat them standing up in the kitchen, reading fashion magazines.
Why standing up?
Oh, it's weird, but it just feels great.
I like to put Vaseline on my hands and put them in those Borghese conditioning gloves while watching infomercials.
Before I was married, I used to study my pores in a magnifying mirror for an hour each night. But I'm afraid Trey will just think it's weird.
Well, he would. You can't do that stuff in front of men. What about you, Lolita? Anything you do you wouldn't want a man to see?
No. You know I believe her.
So you wrote this. Is this something you've thought about a lot, all those secret things that you do alone that you can't do with your lover around?
It's really interesting for me. And it seemed to be when I started talking to the other writers about it, the idea that people who are single and have been single for a number of years develop certain things that they fall in love with. And they may be even aberrant. You know, they may be just eating cereal in a bowl without breathing, just eating a lot of cereal, which one of the writers told us that she did. She just likes to put cereal in a bowl and eat it dry really fast. And it's just symptomatic of when somebody moves into your life, how suddenly you're visible. And it's interesting in like a city like New York, where everybody's so in each other's faces that when you close your door, and it can be in any city, when you close your door and you're completely alone, there's a relaxed emotional sigh that goes up, like, no one can see me do this. No one is seeing me do this, whatever it is. And the secret singer behavior we talked about on the show is all accurate to each of the female writers that I was talking to. The gloves, putting on the gloves with conditioning that Miranda does, and then, of course, the comedy writer in me added while watching infomercials. But the actual idea of looking at your pores for an hour, but all that stuff is really interestingly idiosyncratic and personal and somehow embarrassing. The most interestingly, I think, perceptive, accurate thing I've written about myself is when Carrie says at the end of that episode to Aiden, I know this is weird, but please don't talk to me for an hour. I'm going to be behind here. You be over there. And then she doesn't need it.
This is when she comes home and she's
says,
used to coming home alone, and suddenly she comes home and there's a boyfriend.
Right, because
there.
He's in there and he's talking to her,
to
and she doesn't
right
know
away.
How to process asking for private space. Mm-hmm. So the whole, you know, the thing about our episodes is sometimes it's a huge, big deal over one tiny request. She didn't know how to say, I need an hour when no one talks to me, because she's been single so long. She hasn't had to ask for that. So when she actually does ask for it, and he has no problem with it, of course, because it's her stuff, as soon as she gets it, she has like 30 seconds, and she's like, I'm done. What are you doing? And that is accurate, I think, to who I am, the idea that you ask for something. And then and the last line of the episode is, that's the thing about needs. Sometimes when you get them met, you don't need them anymore.
My guest is Michael Patrick King, the executive producer and one of the writers of Sex and the City. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Sex and the City begins its fifth season Sunday. Let's get back to our interview with executive producer and writer Michael Patrick King, recorded last winter.
Do you feel like you learned some of the things that you don't want to do, things that have become cliches in terms of writing for TV, from getting started working on other shows before you worked on Sex and the City?
Oh, I know so much about how not to write TV. It's amazing. I had a very blessed experience in that I started on my first really good show was Murphy Brown, and that was at the height of when Murphy Brown was, I started the year she got pregnant, and Diane English, who created that show and ran it, was really spectacular. She had five writers that she respected, and her job as the showrunner, which is the executive producer, is to listen to the voices in the room and find out what they think and then incorporate all those voices into one script. And so I had a really good experience there. So I know what the target was to shoot for. But, I mean, I've had really bad experiences where as soon as you start to open your mouth to pitch an idea, they go, won't work, can't happen, not likable, don't like the character, it's only 20 minutes long, you're trying to do too much, what's the subtext about? And the other thing that's really, really, I think, destructive in television right now is there are very few shows that actually let writers write, where you actually get a writer and say, oh, that's his voice. Let Michael write that one. Let Julie write that. Let Amy write that. It's instead, it's gang, they call them gang-written scripts, where something goes wrong at the table read. These are four-camera sitcoms I'm talking about. I really don't have any expertise in dramas or other one-camera shows, which is what Sex and the City is, which is like a little movie. But these are when you go in front of an audience and the audience is there and they're applauding and they're waiting to hear the big jokes. As soon as something goes wrong, there's a tendency to go back to the writing room, throw out the last 3 months of thoughts that you've all put into this idea, and just go like a pop bead, pop, pop, pop. Put this joke next to this joke, next to this joke, next to this joke. What do you say? What do you say? And it works in terms of it makes people laugh, but it doesn't really give you anything, in my opinion, it doesn't give you anything to believe in or relate to. You're not turning in every week to see what happens to people. You're waiting to see the funny thing.
Now, you were a consultant on, mm-hmm. on Will and Grace,
yeah.
I think during the first
I was in the
season.
We finished the first season of Sex and the City. Darren and I wrote all of them. It was just Darren Starr and I. We did the entire season. And then we were done before they were on the air. And we didn't know what was going to happen. And Max Muchnick and David Cohan, who created Will and Grace, asked me to come over. And I joined them for the first 12 episodes of that series, which was really fun to start because it's an entirely different muscle. And the writing room was really funny, and they're very smart. And it was fun to help begin to shape a new show.
In what sense is it a different muscle than Sex and the City?
It's the Olympics. It's and for years after I you know, Sex and the City came back on the air, and I couldn't be on staff of Will and Grace, but I would go over on show night, which is in front of the audience, and they used me as punch up, and I would put jokes in the moment where you're watching a show and you go, maybe if, boom. And everybody's putting jokes in, and you run up to the actors and say them, and they say them back, and the audience hears them. It's really like a vault versus like an Olympic swimming event where you just have to vault, boom, off that horse, and you have to hit that mark, and you know exactly right now if it worked.
Now, how do you do that without falling into the trap that you were talking about before, where it's just like joke, 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 but there's no real investment in the story?
It all gets in. It all comes into the individuals. I mean, joke, joke, joke. Can be really good too if the jokes are based on character or the person pitching them is unique and funny. But, you know, Will and Grace tell stories and they're a whole other thing. They're like a Millennium Noel Coward or something. I mean, they're all about dialogue and those four characters. And it's, you know, the difference between a network sitcom and what we do on HBO is that network sitcoms are 20 minutes long. 20 minutes, 21 minutes. And I can have my show be 30 minutes. And that seems like only 9 minutes, but that's 9 minutes of character, 9 minutes of story. You know, you get to go a little bit deeper because you have that extra 9 minutes. It really doesn't matter how important the story is, because it has to end at a certain time. Whereas I can actually pick up the phone and say to HBO, I need 2 more minutes. I need 2 more minutes. And then we debate about whether I need 2 more minutes, and then I do get the 2 minutes. So, I mean, it's just a different animal. And then the other thing, which is what we do on Sex and the City, which is the girls are sort of, they make jokes to make each other laugh. You know what I mean? There are jokes that we say, well, that's too big of a joke. We did a joke about the Guggenheim Museum last year, which is a wonderfully crafted joke between four writers. You know, when four writers are making a joke, you know it's a joke. But we made a joke about when Charlotte, it was in an episode where Charlotte hadn't looked at her vagina. And Carrie said, she says to Carrie, have you looked at your vagina? And she says, I think of it like the Guggenheim. Whenever I'm in the neighborhood, I stop by and see what's on. But I get confused and a little dizzy. And, you know, we thought, oh, Carrie comparing her vagina to the Guggenheim. It's brilliant. And then when we filmed it, we went, well, that's just a bunch of joke writers sitting in her head, working her like a puppet. A character. Carrie would never say that.
Right. So you
and eventually the joke turned into, Carrie, have you looked at yours? And Carrie said, how'd I get involved?
Right.
And that seemed more right for our show because it's Carrie's true attitude about it rather than, look how clever we are. We built a joke and now Sarah Jessica's doing it well. And she did it perfectly. But she also did look at me like, is that all right? And I knew, okay, it's a joke. We put a joke in the show. And the writing in our show is more about we get to show off a little bit. If I'm Will and Grace, they get to show off in the jokes. We get to show off in Carrie's column or the narrative. You know what I mean? Or mm-hmm. our turns of phrases. We have our thing, too.
Well, Michael Patrick King, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, it has been my pleasure.
Michael Patrick King recorded last winter. He's the executive producer of Sex and the City and has written and directed many episodes. The fifth season begins Sunday on HBO. Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie, K-19. This is Fresh Air. K-19, The Widowmaker, is a new movie based on a true Cold War story. It stars Harrison Ford and Liam Neeson as officers of a Soviet nuclear submarine facing a crisis at sea.
Director Kathryn Bigelow's new movie, K-19, features chases, special effects hardware, a mile-a-minute Steadicam, and pedal-to-the-metal editing. So just as summer in the northern forest brings forth the cry of the loon, so too we have had the usual collection of media stories about how wonderful it is that Hollywood boasts a woman who can direct action films so well. This tired but predictable assertion begs two questions. First, what makes anyone think there are any American men out there who can direct action movies well? I can't think of more than two or three unless you count recent immigrants. Secondly, what is an action movie anyway? The term itself isn't that old, and what it means is frankly commercial. Let's take a look at K-19, which starts out at least in a conventional manner. In 1961, a Soviet submarine, the titular K-19, is in a dry dock being outfitted for a special mission. Its captain, Mikhail Polenin, played with appealing energy by Liam Neeson, is so outraged by the shoddiness and inadequacies of the supplies and repairs that his unceasing protests cost him his command. He's demoted to executive officer, and his post is handed to Alexei Vostrikov, a taciturn older man who has none of Polenin's easy leadership abilities and who's played by Harrison Ford in his familiar subdued mode. The mission involves getting close to American reconnaissance in order to shoot a test missile that will warn NATO of Soviet military capabilities. Vostrikov, who's been running nonstop drills that have brought the crew to the edge of their frayed nerves, accomplishes the mission, but practically destroys the sub in the process. His maneuvers bring the long simmering tensions between him and Polenin to the surface.
You will be in my report for leaving your post. And you will be in mine! You needlessly endangered this boat and its crew. 200 million Soviet citizens are depending on us, Captain Vostrikov, to save them from nuclear attack. You risked them as well. I took this boat and these men to the edge because we need to know where it is. These 120 men are a crew now because they achieved something together that they did not think they could do. Next time, when it is not a drill, they will go to the edge and past it and die if necessary because that is what their duty demands of them.
K-19 is based on a true story, one that was locked away in the Soviet archives for decades after all evidence of it was scoured from the seas. After having accomplished its missile launch, K-19 was ordered to patrol along the U.S. coastline, but on its way, the nuclear-powered sub twice developed catastrophic problems with its reactor. Doubly haunted by the poor equipment on board, both by the initial breakdown and the lack of adequate tools, the men on board became exposed to radiation sickness. Beyond that, the nuclear core was likely to begin a chain reaction that could have ended with an explosion larger than the one at Hiroshima. But since this was a true story, and we know there never was a huge mushroom cloud over the mid-Atlantic, Bigelow can't focus merely on what the larger outcome of K-19's nuclear crisis could be. This brings her back around to the tension between Polenin and Vostrikov and to the way that tension coursed through the crew. Bigelow's mastery of what's called action, or pure kinetic energy, is superior. There's a lot of thrilling submarine work, and you can imagine what a missile launch is like in the hands of a filmmaker who can make even a soccer match played on Arctic ice exuberantly exciting. But her real focus, as it has been from her vampire film Near Dark through her extravagant Strange Days, is on human action. Liam Neeson and Harrison Ford both give exceptionally good performances, with the emphasis on exceptional. These two tend to be solitary actors, uninclined to share their emotions with other performers. Bigelow has gotten Neeson to open up, to bleed a little, and thus be the heart of the movie. Ford delivers one of those stoic turns that can be so deadly in other films, as in the two movies he did for Sidney Pollack, Sabrina and Random Hearts. But Bigelow keeps her shots of him short and sharp. Maybe Bigelow should have put a submarine into her last movie, The Weight of Water, which debuted at the 2000 Toronto Film Festival, a tale of sexual intrigue that takes place both today and in 1873. It stars Sean Penn, Sarah Pauley, and Elizabeth Hurley, but has never been released in the U.S. But without that sub or that wild ride, they just can't sell it as a Catherine Bigelow production.
Henry Sheehan is a film critic based in L.A. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Clan of the Cave Bear and all the novels by Jean M. All, already available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet British actor Terrence Stamp. In the 60s, he starred in Billy Budd and The Collector. More recently, he starred in The Limey and The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. He's in the new film, My Wife is an Actress. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.